we'll move on now, in the interest of time, to our first presenter, and that would be Dr. Vince Smith, who is a professor of economics in the Department of Agricultural Economics and Economics at Montana State University, and is co-director of MSU's Agricultural Market Policy Center. He received his PhD from North Carolina State University in 1987 and his bachelor's and master's degrees from the University of Manchester in 1970 and 1971. Vince's current research program examines agricultural trade and domestic policy issues, with a particular focus on agricultural insurance, agricultural science policy, domestic and world commodity markets, risk management, and agricultural trade policy. He's authored and edited 9 books and monographs and published over 140 articles and book chapters on agricultural economics, agricultural policy, and other economic issues. In 2008, he became a distinguished scholar of the Western Agricultural Economics Association, and in 2011, he received the Bruce Gardner Award for outstanding contributions to the economic analysis work of the USDA. I've had a number of opportunities to work with Vince over the last decade, and it is with great pleasure that I welcome him today. Vince, with that, the floor is yours.
John, thank you very much. And good morning and almost good afternoon to everybody, at least the people on the East Coast. And hopefully you're all warmer than I am, because I'm sitting in Washington, D.C., where the weather is, as the English would say, just lovely. Below 20 and snowing, and nothing is working properly in D.C. Hopefully my hookup will work and we'll do well. The title I've chosen for the talk is deliberate. Where are we going and how are we going? And the answer is, we don't really know, not least because of all the choices that exist within the new policy environment created by the 2014 Farm Bill. So I thought I'd just list a few things that we do and we don't know. So what do we know? There's a Farm Bill. Well, that's a change, because we weren't quite sure if we were ever going to get one over the last 2 years. And it's been passed by both the House and the Senate, we know that. And it's been signed by the President, that is, President Obama. The bill's 930 pages plus long, but that's not really telling the whole story, because it's really over 2,000 pages, as much of the bill consists of amendments to previous legislation. And the bill will probably be 20,000 plus pages long by the time USDA has written all of the implementation rules and handbooks for each of the programs to be managed by agencies like the Farm Service Agency, NRCS, and the Risk Management Agency, which will have a lot of fun trying to sort out how to handle the special coverage option, which is a new insurance policy. What else do we know? Well, most of us haven't read all the bill. Some of us, none of it. And most of us never will read all the bill. It's pretty intimidating. And even if we've read it, we're pretty sure, most of us, that we don't understand what most of it means. And that includes, I think, the people in USDA who are trying to write the implementation rules, because there are some ambiguities, to put it mildly, in the language in some parts of the bill. This is an important issue in the following sense, in that we will not really know what choices farmers have until the implementation rules for signing up for different programs have been developed and published. And it's only then that we'll fully understand what the options facing farmers are. We do know the bill's new name. It's the Agricultural Act of 2014. But most of us won't remember the name, because we always call them farm bills. Most of us won't remember the act. We do know the bill's acronym. It will be AA, which has been used by at least one other very well-known organization and could be viewed as unfortunate, but is neither fair nor fact for those of us who remember the acronyms of previous farm bills. We do know that the farm bill creates a complicated set of choices for farmers. And those choices are complex in several dimensions, especially with respect to the programs that have been introduced in Title I and Title 11. Title I is the farm subsidy title, as traditionally thought of, where loan rates and so on are discussed and established and the legislation described. Title 11 is the new title for the crop insurance program. Title 11 is really quite incomplete in some senses because most of the legislation that guides crop insurance is to be found in other acts, for example, the Agricultural Risk Protection Act of 2000. For many farmers, where they have a choice about which program they can use, for example, price loss coverage, that's PLC, or agricultural risk coverage, that's ARC, right now, neither they nor I, or certainly we, I shouldn't say I, neither they nor we know what they should do. And there's a big reason for this. No one really knows what the prices of corn, wheat, rice, peanuts, and other commodities will be over the next 5 years. And as I'll show you later on, not too much later on, because we're going to try and keep this talk to 30 minutes, there is a lot of ambiguity about what might happen with prices. And in fact, what prices for major commodities do determines which program would be providing the largest amount of payments for individual farmers. And it's important to recognize that farm choices will be affected by the implementation rules for each program that are currently being developed by the various agencies that manage those programs within USDA. And again, this is a very important question, and there's still a great deal of ambiguity about how the programs will be managed. For example, as I'll discuss a little later, there's an issue with base updating. Farmers in the Act are given the choice of staying with the existing base acres and yields that they have used to receive direct payments under the direct payments program or countercyclical payments under the countercyclical payments program. But they will be given the opportunity to update those bases. There are complex issues associated with particularly cotton acreage that is because of the nature of the change in the cotton program, the shift really effectively into mainly what's called the stacked income protection program that's embedded in the new farm bill. The stacks program, by the way, can best be thought of as simply a more attractive version of the special coverage option. They're really very similar programs. And while we're talking about cotton, in some senses, cotton producers are fortunate because they really do only have to worry about, am I going to participate in the stacks program and what do I do with my orphaned cotton base acres? Now, I'm not going to get into the details of cotton orphaned base acres. That's for a future webinar. But for cotton producers, that's a very interesting issue, and what they do will be heavily dependent on the implementation rules that are developed by the Farm Service Agency. So what's not in the bill? What's gone? Well, direct payments, as we all know, about $4.9 billion worth a year of direct payments to farmers, checks that come through the mail, January or February or December, well, they're gone. No more direct payments. The ACRE program, which is the original shallow loss program developed in the 2008 Farm Bill, that's gone. No more ACRE. It's been replaced by price loss coverage and or agricultural risk coverage. Countercyclical payments, well, they're gone, but not really, because in practice, the new price loss coverage program is essentially the countercyclical payments program with updated base yields, base acres, and much higher prices that will trigger payments. And that's another issue that I'll talk about in a little while. The SURE program, the supplementary revenue program for crops, the disaster aid program that was tied into a variety of other programs, that's gone. And the dairy price support program and milk income loss contract program, those are all gone to be replaced by the new dairy margin program, which some people call insurance because you can buy up to get additional coverage. But quite a few of the programs that are being referred to commonly as if they're insurance are really subsidy programs rather than insurance programs. So the exceptions are stacks and the supplementary coverage option program. Well, what's new? Well, we've got what I've called the Big Four in Titles 1 and 11. So Title 1 is the traditional commodities program title, and Title 11 is crop insurance. Well, the first new program is PLC, Price Loss Coverage. In that program, payments will be made when they're available on historically determined payment acres with higher support prices than under the countercyclical payments program. How much higher? A lot higher, and this is pretty well known, but I'll illustrate the issue later in the discussion. The Agricultural Risk Coverage Program. That is also a program in which payments will be made on historically determined payment acres, again with a different structure of support than has previously existed. The Agricultural Risk Coverage Program is a program under which, using the five previous years of estimated revenues, either at the county or the farm level, a proven, if you like, revenue is established on a per acre basis. When at either the county or the farm level, depending on which option chosen by the farmer is utilized, the estimated revenue per acre falls below 86% of the established expected revenue, payment is made. And that payment is capped at 10% of the expected revenue, which is the five-year average, computed using the Olympic average method, which I always think of as the Russian judge method in figure skating. You drop the high and the low marks, in this case, the high and the low revenues. Price Loss Coverage Program is really a countercyclical payments program where payments will be triggered when prices fall below, on a national average basis, the reference levels, which you can think of as the trigger price levels for payments. There is base updating at the farmer's choice. And the farmer's choice is a real choice here because for some crops, base updating is clearly preferred. They will get much larger amount of production on which they will be paid when payments are available. For other crops, base updating may not be as attractive. It just depends on each farm's situation. And then we have the supplementary coverage option, which is a new insurance program. It is a group risk insurance program under which when whatever is being insured, and this is going to be at the county level, falls below 86% of its expected value, payments will be made. Those payments are capped at the difference between whatever the farmer has chosen as their underlying insurance product, say a multiple peril insurance product in terms of coverage, say 70%, and 86%. So in that case, the farmer would get a maximum 16% of their expected revenue under the contract as a payment, all of which is wonderfully simple. And then the cotton stacks program is essentially an expanded and more heavily subsidized SCO group-based insurance program. It will be based on the county or crop reporting district level, depending on the data that the National Agricultural Statistical Service have available. The subsidy will be 80% of the expected indemnity under the program. That is 80% of the expected actuarially fair premium for the coverage. So that's sort of a program where if you put a dollar down, on average, you're going to get $5 back. Sort of deal that I'd love to have in Las Vegas. Other changes in farm subsidy programs. Well, in the Title I has the Livestock Indemnity and Livestock Forage Disaster Aid programs. Both of those are refunded and will be implemented retroactively for losses of forage or exceptional losses of livestock or morbidity of livestock in 2012 and 2013. And FSA is moving very quickly on implementing these programs for 2012 and 2013. With implementation rules being developed right now, perhaps almost complete, and farm applications being expected, I believe, either March 15th or April 15th is the beginning date for applications. So that's a major issue for education on the part of the extension program. And then we have the new milk producer program called the Dairy Margin Protection Program. There's a great deal of debate in the farm bill about whether or not there should be supply controls attached to this participation in this program. That proposal was killed eventually at the insistence of the Speaker of the House. So there's no supply control embedded in this program. But if you're a smaller dairy farm, you'll get larger subsidies on a per hundredweight of milk program under this program than will larger dairy farms. And that's all I'm going to say about dairy. It's a complex issue, and it deserves its own program. We've got the Conservation Reserve Program, and that will continue. With funding for only 25 million acres by 2016, and funding is scheduled at about $1.2 billion a year. Now, this is an interesting issue because the farm lobbies were very supportive of reductions in the Conservation Reserve Program when they expected corn prices to be more in the $5 or $6 range, and commensurately prices for other small grains and oilseeds to be relatively high. With expected moderation in those prices, the Conservation Reserve Program will be somewhat more appealing to many of the lobbying groups for farmers, and it's not clear to anyone that over the next 2 years we wouldn't see modifications to the amount of acreage that goes in that program. It depends on what happens to the price of corn, the price of wheat, and so on. Other conservation programs will be combined under the Act, for example, the various conservation easement and reserve programs. R&D funding for public research may be increased. We've seen an increase in appropriations by the Agricultural Appropriations Committee for this coming year. There's no indication there will be reductions in public R&D spending, and that's probably a very good thing, given most of the evidence on the gains and on the benefits from publicly funded agricultural research for pretty much everybody in the country. Farm subsidy program payment limits, well, no major changes to payment limits, even though there was a great deal of discussion in the debates over the farm bill about tightening restrictions on availability of subsidies. Payments per farm under the price loss coverage and agricultural risk coverage programs are notionally capped at about $250,000. Exactly $250,000, assuming that there are two eligible persons per farm to receive subsidies. That's a little more complicated world, and again, this is an overview rather than a detailed discussion of payment limits. But that's a big change from what might have been expected a year ago, where payment limits were given a great deal of focus. There are some restrictions on the absolute amount of disaster aid payments a farm can receive, about $100,000 a year. There are no limits on crop insurance premium subsidies whatsoever. Again, this was an issue that received a great deal of attention, involved a proposed amendment to the House bill that failed to pass by just a few votes. But in the end, the committees were strongly supportive of no limits on crop insurance premium subsidies in the House and Senate. How much budget savings are there in the bill? Well, CBO has estimated $1.6 billion a year. Spending on farm programs, that's the red tip of what looks like two cigarettes, down from $20.8 billion, which is the estimate of what they would be if the 2008 Farm Bill were continued, to $20 million under the 2014 Farm Bill. Nutrition cuts would be about $800 million a year, down from $76.4 billion to $75.6 billion. But those numbers are probably wrong. The CBO used relatively high prices for corn, wheat, and so on in estimating the costs of the 2014 Farm Bill, and USDA has put out some recent estimates of much lower prices for corn, wheat, and soybeans that imply much larger spending on agricultural subsidies than CBO estimated, given it was required to use a relatively high price baseline to calculate the costs of programs like price loss coverage and the agricultural risk coverage program. Let's talk for just a few moments about the PLC AGR choice. That should be the PLC ARC choice, agricultural risk coverage choice. A farm that chooses the PLC does so for all eligible crops for the entire length of the 2014 Farm Bill, that's through 2018. If the farm opts for PLC, then it can also use SCO insurance coverage for individual covered crops. Under the PLC, payments will be made on 85% of a farm's production base for each crop. And if the farm purchases a special coverage option, then it has to make a simultaneous choice about coverage levels in the SCO and its APH-based, typically this is going to be what's called the combo product, that is an actual production history, individual farm insurance program, or another underlying federally subsidized insurance contract for each crop. The two options are linked, and those are going to be decisions that have to be made by the farm. Under the agricultural risk coverage program, the farm choosing ARC does so for all eligible crops for the entire duration of the bill. If it picks the county option, it's paid on 85% of eligible production. If it goes for the individual farm option, where the difference is you're using county yields and the county option and your own farm's yields and your own farm's option, you only get paid on 65% of eligible production. That's a pretty hefty penalty, by the way, for opting to use your own farm yields to establish the farm's per acre expected revenue. If the farm opts for ARC, it cannot participate in the SCO program. They cover the same sorts of losses. The farm can still purchase any underlying federally subsidized crop insurance contract, although given that the ARC shallow loss program, the farm may choose to reconsider coverage levels that it selects under its preferred underlying crop insurance contract, say its APH revenue contract. Lots of choices there, lots of decisions to make at the margin, not easy decisions. And decisions that will be driven in part by particularly what farmers expect prices for the crops they produce or most of their land is allocated to do. So let's just reflect on that again a few minutes. What I put up here is numbers that many of you have seen before. But we're showing the original countercyclical payments payment trigger, which for corn was $2.35 a bushel. Under price loss coverage, which is simply an updated countercyclical payments program, the price triggering payments would be $3.70 per bushel for corn. That's a 57% increase. For wheat, the trigger price has gone from $3.65 to $5.50. So a trigger price, when the national average price falls below those numbers, say $5.50 for wheat, then you would get a payment under price loss coverage. For soybeans, we've had a 66% increase in the trigger price. For peanuts, we have a 17% increase. But if you look at the prices for peanuts historically, $5.35 a ton exceeds the national average price for peanuts in 10 of the previous 12 years. And payments are expected under that program this coming year. For rice, we've seen a 72% increase in the trigger price, although rice prices, as I'll show you very shortly, are expected largely to be above $14 over the next 5 or 6 years, at least according to recent USDA predictions. And for barley, we've seen a 107% increase in the payment trigger. These are substantial changes intended to make the price loss coverage more attractive, meaning more lucrative for most farmers than the countercyclical payments program. Well, if we look at what I've put up now, this is just a history of corn, soybean, and wheat prices. Corn is in red, wheat is in yellow, and soybeans are in green. And as everybody knows, those prices have been relatively high or very high from about 2007 on compared to long-run historical averages. The story for here, we've got rice in blue, peanuts in brown, cotton in black. Story for those commodities is somewhat different. Lots of volatility, not much trend except a little bit of an upward trend for rice, but no trend for peanuts or cotton. Now, I'm running out of time, so I'm not going to spend much time on peanuts, rice, and cotton, with apologies to everybody in Georgia and California and Arkansas. And I'm going to focus just on corn, wheat, and soybeans. Here, I'm showing you the most recent USDA forecasts for prices for these commodities over the period 2013-14 to 17-18, the period covered by the Act. The dotted lines are the prices that under the PLC program would trigger payments. And if you look at soybeans, prices don't look as though they're likely to trigger any payments for soybeans over that period. So if you only produce soybeans, because it is still the case that there's a downward trend in those prices, you're likely to go for agricultural risk coverage. But of course, we know that most soybeans are raised by farms that combine soybean production with corn production, at least in the I states, Indiana, Illinois, Iowa, and related states like Ohio, related in the sense that they're the corn belt. And for corn, we see that in several years, corn prices are going to be below, and it doesn't look by much, but it actually looks, it is fairly substantially below, the new reference price or trigger price for payments under price loss coverage. So corn growers have to think a little bit about whether they want to go into ARC or PLC, because prices for corn look like they're going to decline. And then for wheat, it looks very much like prices for wheat, at least according to USDA estimates, are going to be well below their trigger price, and so price loss coverage may look very attractive for wheat. Here's the problem. The futures prices for those crops are substantially higher. The futures prices at a time of harvest, say in December 2015 and September 2015 for corn and wheat, are much higher than those being predicted by USDA. So there's a lot of ambiguity about where prices are going to go. And if your prices are declining for your crop, but above price loss coverage trigger reference prices, you're really going to find ARC likely to be very interesting to you. So here's the dilemma, of course. Nobody really knows where the prices of these crops are going. So lots of ambiguity there. So finally, I want to spend one or two moments talking about base updating. Farmers will be given a choice between keeping their current base for each crop or updating yields. And that choice may be clear-cut for some producers and less clear-cut for other producers. And just to illustrate the issue, I'm just going to show you a table drawn from a piece of work done by Barry Goodwin and myself quite recently, where we looked at what would happen with base updating simply to direct payments if they stayed around. And that's just illustrative. And you can see that for corn, the percentage change in the base amount of production eligible for payments is substantially higher if you update, 23.1% higher, effectively. And the same is true for soybeans, very much substantially higher in the case of soybeans. But for some other crops, for example, cotton, and wheat, because of substantial declines in acreage allocated to those crops, and rice would be in the same position, not because of declines in yields, base yields have grown substantially since 2002, when you were last allowed to base update. But what these numbers tell us is there's a lot of complexity here for each farmer in deciding whether or not to base update. And so it's going to be very important for extension educators to look at the issue of base updating for us to correctly model and explain what the implications of base updating will be. And the truth is we can only do that when we know the implementation rules. So there it's a little bit of a wait and see. Take-home messages. Well, the evidence is that at least since 2002, when farm subsidy programs changed, they become more complicated. And the House and Senate Ag Committees have done their level best to ensure, therefore, that there'll be lots of work for agricultural economists and extension educators, so we should be very grateful to them for that. And the real question for the farm sector in deciding among the new programs, above anything else, is sorting out what they think will happen to the prices of major crops over the next 5 years. And that, in truth, is very tricky. That may depend in some part on whether or not the renewable fuels mandate will be enforced or effectively allowed to atrophy, or whether it will be abandoned. And along with that, whether or not USDA, as the Secretary indicated last week, will do its level best to find new subsidies for ethanol plants. So lots of ambiguities here, lots of things to sort out, but hopefully this overview has been helpful for you. Thank you.
No, Vince, thank you for those excellent comments. Very insightful and helps to draw some clarity to what is somewhat of a confusing situation at present. So again, thank you very much for those. We have a number of questions that have come in here. And so what I'd like to do is ask just a couple of them now, and then we'll have a panel discussion of all three of our presenters at the end. So the first of those questions comes in here is are payments decoupled from production?
Great question, and the answer is depends on the prism through which you're looking at them. These are all amber box payments under PLC and ARC when it comes to the World Trade Organization under the terms of the Marrakesh Treaty and the Agricultural Annex. Are they decoupled? That's a much more complicated question. And on a bad day, I can make a case that they are decoupled. On another bad day, I can make the case that they are not decoupled. The evidence is that they are going to be based on recent historical production. However, one of the problems with true decoupling is that if you say we're going to update base every farm bill or every other, or we're likely to, then you've just recoupled some of that farm decision. Now, not very much. Under the WTO rules, however, it's unambiguous because payments are going to be triggered by current market conditions, prices, and by yields, current yields. These have to be declared to be amber box programs.
Okay, great. And to kind of follow up on that, another participant asks, do farmers or landowners have the final say on updating those base acres, or do we know enough details to answer that yet?
Well, there's a lot of language in the bill on who gets to choose what's what. One reading of the bill would be that the farmer and the landowner may be able to make different decisions, which would be really quite administratively hair-raising. So I'm going to take the fifth on that and say, let's see what the implementation rules say. It's very clear that for base updating, the lessee and the lessor will have to sit down and sort that one out. It's also the case that the lessee and the lessor will have to sit down and sort out which program they're going to go into, assuming they're going to participate in the program. Are they going to go into the agricultural risk coverage program or price loss coverage program? And those are questions that will have to be sorted out. But we do need to wait for implementation rules to some extent, and I believe. One of our next speakers may be more adequately able to address that question.
We do have Jonathan on the dock to actually address the implementation to some degree. There's one other question, though, that's kind of tied to that that I thought I'd put to you, Vince, is the questioner asks, when do we anticipate the new programs of PLC and ARC to become effective?
I have no clue. It depends on whose claims you believe. It will be any time, in my judgment, between June 15th and July 31st. Pick a date. The real challenge is getting the implementation rules sorted out, making sure going through the Federal Register process for these implementation rules, and there will be politics involved. I am sure that various lobbying groups will have a lot to say about preliminary proposals. One way or the other.
I'm sure you're right. And so, in the interest of time, first let me say thank you again very much, Vince. Excellent comments and answers. Hopefully you'll be able to stay with us to take a few more at the end.
Be happy to do it.